Welcome to Oak City Church, a family of learners, lovers, and givers sent. For more information, visit us online at oakcitychurch.com. Let us know if we can help you in any way. Thank you for listening.
We're in a series in the book of Ecclesiastes. We took a little break last week, and we're back for the last 4 weeks. My kids are obsessed with a television show called Bones. Does anybody watch this show? Bones. I think it's called Bones because her name is like Dr. Bones or something like that. Someone who watches this knows this better than I do. Then that seems convenient. But also, like, they study, they're medical examiners or something, and so they study dead people, and it's gross. It's a gross show. Every time I walk in, I said, this is disgusting, and I don't know why you guys watch this. It goes back all the way back to, like, a genre of shows that goes back to Quincy. Does anybody remember Quincy? Yes. So he was like the original, and like he has a bunch of grandchildren now, like that are studying medical examiner stuff. And what happens at the end of that show? Every single show, what happens? They get the bad guy. Every single time they find the bad guy, right? They study the bones and they find something with their microscope. And they see something that people didn't see before, and they use all their resources and all their smartness, and they get the bad guy. How many shows on TV are that storyline over and over and over again, get the bad guy shows? How many? What percentage of shows on TV do you think are get the bad guy shows? I mean, it's a lot. I don't know that it's 90%, but it's because there's a lot of shows on TV, y'all, but it's a lot. It's a lot. My kids also love NCIS. And there's like several versions of that. They were too young for CSI, but it's like every major city in America had a version of CSI dedicated to it. 24 might fall in any 24 watchers. Yeah, it's the ultimate get the bad guy. I hear he's coming back. Jack might be back, so that's good. We have been, when Bobby Joe and I watch, when we just have some time at night and we're just want to do nothing, we'll watch The Blacklist. We're in like season 4 of The Blacklist, which is like a morally conflicted get the bad guy while you are the bad guy, trying to figure out who the bad guy is show. But it's all that stuff. And so my kids love the show. I don't know if they're so obsessed with justice because they feel like they don't get justice at home. And so they long for justice. And so this is some passive aggressive message that they're sending to us. But I get this out of all these TV shows. We crave justice. We long for justice, right? And it's all like all the time, this week I saw something about a serial killer that they have figured out was like the most prolific serial killer in history of America. He's killed like 90 people. They're still trying to tie murder. And so you understand why people want justice for that. And the DNA kits, have you done one of these DNA kits? I did one. Last Christmas, somebody got me one of those DNA kits. I'm the only person that's done a DNA kit. Well, you got to be careful because you got to think through your family and if any of them might have done something bad that they can find through these DNA kits, because they're using like DNA kits to figure out that the relative of this person was this person, and like the Golden State killer, they found that guy through it. And so we're longing for these justice, like, I mean, and rightfully. We want closure, you know. Every once in a while, you'll get these stories of folks that have been in prison for like 20 or 30 years, and then the DNA kit proves that they didn't do it and somebody else did it. And so they get out, and you're like just broken. Those stories captivate me. The thought that somebody's life was largely spent falsely imprisoned because of that. So we crave justice. We crave closure. I think that those shows point to that. I think our obsession with sports in some ways points to this because sports offers it's done in a few hours. There's a winner and there's a loser. Your work is going to pay off or not pay off in the field of competition, and you get a chance to go at it and do it again. Like, we long for this. I think there's a book I read years ago by a guy named Donald Miller, and he suggested this, like if an alien came down and knew nothing about what was going on here, the thing that they would find the weirdest that we have just totally grown used to. He said it's that we compare ourselves to each other all the time, which is totally true. Like, we do, and we don't even realize we're doing it all the time. You know, and an alien would be like, what's your problem? But this craving for justice would be right there with that, because all the time we're looking for it. And the shows wouldn't work. They wouldn't work if even every once in a while Dr. Bones was like, I don't know. Guess we can't figure that one out. You know, like, we just wouldn't happen that way. My grandpa always wanted Wile E. Coyote to catch the Roadrunner. Like, just one time, you know. But it's never going to happen. And it's never going to happen with those shows. I wonder if we long so desperately for justice and closure in our art and entertainment because it happens so infrequently in our lives. Like, if it's just a reflection that we feel like we don't have that. Not at the levels of, like, serial killers. And like, not for most of us that type of closure, but just closure in, like, smaller things. Or things that we view around us that are bigger, that we just, they bother us, but things, you know, relationally in our lives that we think, man, I wish this would resolve, but it's not going to resolve. Do you feel like the pieces don't fit as neatly together as you would like them to fit together? Because I totally get that. And Solomon totally gets that. But Solomon, and this is like a repeated theme throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, has some maybe troubling news. Over and over again, he's going to say, under the sun, in this life, we got to get used to that because those pieces aren't going to fit together the way that we want those pieces to fit together. And we've got to learn how to deal with that. And learning how to deal with that is wisdom. Is wisdom. The series that we've been going through, I titled Finding Contentment in a Restless World, because I really do think it offers a path to contentment, but it's not an easy path. I was thinking this week about this passage from the Apostle Paul in Philippians. He says, not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. A few years ago, that really stuck out to me. Contentment is a learned behavior. It's not something that comes natural to us. But it is something that we can acquire, something that we can learn. And he says, I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. And in either of those extremes, I found contentment. And it's not that he just checked out. Paul never quit, man. Paul was a hard charger. But in the midst of either one of those extremes, Paul found contentment through some other avenue. In any and every circumstance, in any and every circumstance, he learned how to be content. I long for that, for me and for you. I learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. And then he points to Christ. I can do all things through him who gives me strength. And that's not talking about dunking a basketball, right, or whatever we put on the t-shirts. That's talking about learning how to live with contentment. And I think Solomon speaks to that a lot in the book of Ecclesiastes. So the first 2 weeks of the series, I spent really putting it in context of the Bible and then digging out the cavity and talking about the problem. Toil and vapor is what he talks about. And so what does he mean by that? And how do we experience toil and vapor? And then the last 2 weeks of the series, it's like Solomon said, okay, here are two paths that I tried to find contentment, and these totally didn't work, and you're trying them too, but just stop it. And one of those was stuff as the secret to contentment in life, and the other was sex as the key to contentment in life. And so I spent 2 weeks on that. You go back and listen to those, but we are, in our culture, we are desperately trying to go down those paths and seeing if they will, like, make us content. And Solomon's saying they won't, and we are finding that they won't. These next 2 weeks, this week and next week, I want to talk about two realities that he says we got to deal with. We got to accept. We have to accept. And one is that you will not eliminate toil in your life. And so that gets to this idea of justice and closure, and he says you will not eliminate toil in your life. You can find joy in toil, but you cannot eliminate toil. And some of you are like, well, duh, you can't eliminate toil. And others of you are squirming in your seat and ready to fight me because you think you can fix everything. And I'm kind of in your camp. And underneath that is a refusal to accept that we are not God. So that's a bit of where we're going today. And next week is a reality to accept that God is sovereign over every situation in your life. God is sovereign over every situation in your life. And then the last 2 weeks, I'm going to talk about two realities to embrace, one of which is the fear of God and learning how to do that. And the other is the discipline of joy, because joy is a discipline and he calls us to it and is totally available to us, even in the midst of all these other things. So here's some Solomon on justice. Again, I saw all the impressions every single time I practiced this. I said impressions, like Solomon's like that Frank Caliendo guy. He's really funny, man. I saw all of them and they were hilarious. All the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold the tears of the oppressed. And they had found, they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. That is extreme language. That is like, man, Solomon, did you have to go there? Like, but if you think about it, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. When we started, way back when we started the church, before we started the church, we had worked through this video that came out forever ago called Invisible Children. Does anybody remember Invisible Children? It was some USC film students, as like a project, went to Uganda, northern Uganda, and ended up just in places they shouldn't have been, investigating this rebel crazy guy army, Joseph Kony, who would abduct children from villages in northern Uganda, bring them into his army. So they were child soldiers, and make them do horrific things. Like, you know, he'd abduct two brothers and make one brother kill the other brother so that the kid couldn't go back to the village because he'd killed somebody, and he couldn't go back to his family because he killed his brother. Like, he made these 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old kids do this type of stuff. You know, the girls would go in, and the older soldiers would take them as a wife and have children with, I mean, and then they had to come back to the society and be reoriented. Like, just stuff that, it broke us. And a group of people got engaged in that and went over to Uganda. I think Alan would say that's part of what got him to Nicaragua, was his involvement in that. Oppressions that are under the sun that will just break you. A few years after that, we had a woman here named Kim Smith. Not our Kim Smith, but another Kim Smith, who was here. And she had dealt with human sex trafficking. And so she talked about how Atlanta is a hotbed of sex trafficking and how there are advertisements in, like, Asian newspapers in New York that men could pay for, like, a day trip down to Atlanta. And the FBI or whatever the agency is that would investigate this stuff had planned a bust of, they were going to break out 1,500 girls from basements of suburban Atlanta homes. They were kept in suburban Atlanta homes, like random homes. And so they'd planned this bust. And they ended up, someone broke word about it, so they ended up getting 150 of them. But they got a ledger of what that organization charged for various services, what men could purchase from these girls. And it's the first time that I ever prayed, Jesus, come back right now, like right this second. Wrap it up, do what you're going to do, but stop that. Solomon saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. He saw all of it, and he said, I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. I don't know if you can get there. I can get there. Like, that's a harsh thing to say, but I can get there, because we are largely protected from so much stuff. And we have no idea the atrocities that go on, the oppressed all over the world and what they go through. He keeps coming back to this. If you see in a province, the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, don't be amazed at the matter. He's seen so much of it that he's like, man, like, don't let it surprise you. It's happening all over the place. Don't pretend that it's not happening. And then he says something, and this is translated different ways in different versions, and I think this probably isn't a great translation, but it's the one I use all the time. But the commentary I was reading through for this is like, yeah, this isn't, I'll get to it in a second. So the high official is watched by a higher official, and there are yet higher ones over them. So there's officials and officials and officials. I think what he's saying in here is power gets consolidated and stays there. and doesn't get distributed after a while. And he's arguing for systemic inequality. It's kind of a way of saying money stays with money or power stays with power. And man, we're kind of dealing with this in our culture with a growing income inequality. And we don't really know statistically if it's that much different than it was in the 20s before the Great Depression or whatever. But like to us, it seems like, you know, the middle class isn't moving anywhere and it's growing more. And he sees this stuff and says, well, that's just the way that it is. People with power are going to keep power and consolidate power. I can buy that. When I stepped into ministry 20 some years ago, I kind of stepped out of something, which is a little bit of the rat race of the corporate, you know, career race. You step into ministry and you just know you're entering into a different thing that God's called you to. And so that someone said years ago, like ministers should make enough money so that they're not worried about meeting their needs, but they shouldn't make enough money that anybody thinks, you know what? I think I'll become a pastor. Like I could make some money doing that. Like that would be a bad reason for people to go into ministry, right? And so that makes a lot of sense. But other professions aren't like that. You go into some other professions because you know you can make a lot of money. And so now 20 years on, people have been grinding away at different careers. And so I see peers that are reaping the financial benefits of that. But I'm kind of outside the system because then I also saw people that just didn't have those opportunities or didn't take advantage of them. And I can see that inequality from a little bit of a distance. And so something like CEO pay, and I don't know if you catch this stuff every once in a while, but and I don't know what the numbers are, but how 50 years ago, CEOs of corporations got paid an average of like 20 times what the average worker got paid. Does anybody track this type of stuff? And now it's like 50 times what the average worker makes. So they're making a whole lot more money than they used to make. And on the one hand, I'm like, I don't begrudge anybody for making what they can make. On the other hand, I think power has gotten consolidated at upper levels and people have gotten around people that have the same type of stuff and justified that this is okay. And that's why wages aren't increasing. And then you get into the thing about minimum wage and, you know, the average worker works 2,000 hours a year and minimum wage is like 10 bucks an hour or something. So that's 20,000 bucks a year. You think about trying to live on 20,000 bucks a year and you think, man, we got to do something about that. But at the same time, small businesses are going to go out of business if you double the minimum wage. Like, those are legit concerns, though. You know, power does get consolidated, and something's going to happen with that. And I think that's exactly what Solomon is speaking into. Like, don't be amazed when that stuff happens. The college admission scandals would be an example of this, I think, of how power gets consolidated. And so, you know, there's stuff lately about some actress who's an actor, paid like oodles of money to get their kid into USC. But there was one this week that came up that was local. So some couple had paid like $125,000 to have their daughter's test scores altered so that she could get into Duke. And they were interviewing one of the parents from their home in New York and the other from their home in Aspen. So, I mean, if you could have a home in New York and Aspen, go for it. But they were doing this. And then they interviewed a kid at Duke, a freshman at Duke. It wasn't the girl that had gotten, they didn't identify her, and the kid said, we take a lot of pride in claiming that it's a meritocracy. Now that would mean that everybody's here based on their merits. Like they're here because of their academic achievements or their extracurricular efforts and activities. That's why they're in Duke. She said, but it's not really. I think a lot of people are trying to change the system, but in reality, money is power. That's a freshman at Duke that's benefiting from that, that is engaging it and realizes that's just the case. And like, hello, Solomon, because that's what he's saying. That's just the case. I'll skip that one. Okay. And then Solomon, as if to read our mail, the next verse says, he who loves money is not going to be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. And so he's basically saying, yeah, power's going to get consolidated, money's going to get consolidated. Don't be amazed by it. Really don't worry about it too much because the money's not all that. And that's what I argued a few weeks ago, and that I think is true. When goods increase, they increase, you eat them, and what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? This made me think of, this is kind of an aside, but there's a basketball player named Patrick Ewing who was the head of the NBA Players Association a few years when they were negotiating their contract. And so people were on the players' case for, like, wanting more money. And he said in a press conference, I think I have this. He said, he actually said this in a press conference. We make a lot of money, but we spend a lot of money too. Like, he actually said it, you know? And so people have been killing him for that since then. But I think it just reveals, like, that's a mentality. Now, I guarantee you half the world, like billions of people, would listen to me saying this right now and say, you're him to me. You know what I mean? Like, we could say that about him or somebody that's more, makes more than us, but billions of people would say that to us. And like, why do you spend money on the things that you spend money on when so many people have nothing? Like, it's just, this is the way it works. Another verse, in my vain life I've seen everything. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness and a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. A righteous man who perishes in his righteousness and a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. Have you seen that? Yeah. And now one of the most confusing verses in the Bible. Be not overly righteous. What? Be not, like, a couple of you are looking at that confused right now, like, wait, is that a typo? Be not overly righteous, and don't make yourself too wise. That is not in some navigator's memory verse pack. That was never in there, be not overly righteous. Some of you are thinking, oh, that's a verse I can do. Like, this is my life verse. What is that? You're writing it down. What is that? Ecclesiastes 7, be not overly righteous. Don't make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Don't be overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? That's a hard verse. And I think he's saying, man, know your limits. And some element of don't kill yourself trying to attain the unattainable. You're not God. Stop pretending that you are. The next chapter, there's a vanity that takes place on the earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. This also is vanity. The next chapter, again I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge. But time and chance happen to them all, for man does not know his time, like fish that are taken in an evil net, like birds that are caught in a snare. So the children of man are snared in an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. Like fish that are taken in an evil net and can't get out. I thought about just trying to put this in like levels of maybe injustice that we experience. And some of them are big, societal. These are all personal, but they're societal. They're just bigger things. Human trafficking, like the refugee crisis and all of that, famines, school shootings. Like, that's societal, but it's personal, man. That's personal. Income inequality, big societal things. But then there are personal things, you know. Work. You know, I talked to a lot of you about your jobs and about the jerk who doesn't know what he's doing and they got the promotion instead of you. You know, and now they're your boss. And so you got to work for this guy that has no idea what he's doing. And that just doesn't seem fair. And so you deal with that stuff. Or you've worked hard at your career and you've worked hard in your company, but you end up stuck in what seems like a dead-end situation and you're just not sure where it's going to go and you're not sure what to do next. And it doesn't seem like you're reaping what you sowed. It doesn't seem fair. I think about it personally in the context of family. And so that could take so many different forms. You know, you want kids, but you can't have kids. A lot of people have gone through that situation in our church, and that doesn't seem fair. We've had we've lost lots of children over the years. Some of them in childhood, many of them through miscarriage. And so we've watched families just agonize and wrestle with that. Why? Some of you have experienced divorce, whether personally or whether like your parents got divorced. And so in that level, you've experienced something that just doesn't seem like that's how it should have happened. Maybe that you feel like you've did all the right things, but marriage is a lot harder than you thought it would be. I've thought about adding to my vows when I do weddings, like, I vow not only to deal with the consequences of my own sin, but to deal with the consequences of your sin too, because I know that's what I'm signing up for, because that's the reality of it. And then have kids, and you're going to deal with the consequences of their sin. And that's why family is hard, and we need the gospel so much in the middle of our homes. Because what Solomon is saying is true, and what the Bible says is true. It may be that your kids, who you love more than anything in the world, are just a much bigger challenge. And they just got stuff going on that's hard. We were talking with someone the other day about a mutual friend of ours from a past church who, like, professionally, everything this guy touches turns to gold. He's one of the best guys in the world. His kids have been a giant challenge in his life. And I'm not close enough to know, like, what a burden that is for him, but how you deal with that. There's a level of spiritual injustice, if you will. I mean, a third of the Psalms are Psalms of lament. They're like, God, why? I was listening to a podcast this morning, The Voice of the Martyrs, which is a great podcast. If you're a podcast listener, check out The Voice of the Martyrs. It just talks about the persecuted church around the world. They interviewed the guy from North Carolina, a pastor from North Carolina, that was stuck in Turkey in a Turkish prison for 2 years. Do you remember that from a few years ago? They interviewed him. And him just talking about how he had to deal with feelings like God had completely abandoned him. And doubts and feelings like he was going absolutely crazy in the midst of that. Man, listen to it. There are times spiritually when we feel like that. When God is quiet. Dealing with all of this, like things aren't the way they're supposed to be, and dealing with the wrong way puts you just in a bad place, you know? And so I thought, like, that starts with second guessing. So I've done something wrong, and that must be it. And you may have done something wrong, but you can go so far down that road. I had a friend from our last church who was an elder at the church, and a couple years after we left, he was 10 or 15 years older than me, he committed suicide. And everybody was shocked, man. This was the last guy. And I asked some questions of friends about that, you know, in the months following that. And one guy said he had gotten laid off from IBM. And he was like a legend in the area that he was in IBM. But he got laid off. Corporate. Like, you know what I mean? Anybody can get laid off at any time. It's corporate. But he took it so hard that he told his dad, I made the wrong choice 20 years ago when I went to work for IBM. And that was just a part of the mix that got him to that place. Like second guessing. I must have screwed it up. If you put it all on us and can't just say, no, we live under the sun and it's a mess, then we're going to end up like there's just an unhealthy thing that can go on there. Low self-esteem. What's wrong with me that I can't get it right? Criticism. What's wrong with you that you can't get it right? You know, or them. And so you become overly critical because it's not the way that it's supposed to be and it's got to be somebody's fault. You become a workaholic. I'm going to get this right, no matter how long it takes me to get this right, which is like part of being a control freak. You know, if people would just do what I'd say, then we could get this right. How many people get that? Because I get that. Like, I think we've all got a bit of that in us. And then you just can't get it right, so you get bitter. Well, that's never going to be right. Or you become a martyr. You think, I got to suffer all this stuff because they just can't get it right. And they should just get it right. And then you doubt and think, well, God doesn't really care about this if he's even there. And then you get to a place of like burnout and depression and saying, is anything even worth caring about anymore? And while this stuff in Ecclesiastes is hard, man, I don't like accepting this. But he says it over and over again. And I think he's right about it. So when he says, be not overly righteous and don't make yourself too wise, why should you destroy yourself? He doesn't say, don't be righteous. He didn't say, quit. It's a way of saying, know your limits. that there's a place where you got to chill out and trust God, because you're not him. And you're not going to have it all figured out. And so rest in him. One of the books that I've been reading for this series, he had a line that just stuck out to me. He said, "We're living in a world of people that are trying to be gods, not the least of which is us. So we are going to have problems." We're living in a world of people that are trying to be gods, not the least of which is us. So we're going to have problems. And another one of Solomon's conclusions at the end of one of these passages, "I saw the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much a man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find out." Does that drive anybody else crazy? Gah! I'm going to ask a question of this, and don't respond to me now, but I need a few of you to come up and talk to me afterwards. But how do you respond emotionally to that? Because I imagine that there's some of you, and you need to tell me this, because I just don't know what's going on out there. If you're like, "Jeff, when you asked that question, I was totally lost at that point. Like, I checked out 10 minutes previous. I just need to know, okay? I just need to know. It's okay. I just need to know." But if you're like, however you respond, like, it'd be helpful for me to, you can text me if you got my number. Like, "I just need to know." Because I find that disappointing and eventually relieving. But man, it's a challenge. I thought this years ago, and it rolls around in my head from time to time, that there is an urgency that comes from anxiety, from the feeling that things are out of control and I need to bring them under control, and so that makes me urgent. And then there's an urgency that comes from faith, the belief that God is in control and that he's called us to be a part of the things that he is controlling, but he is the one in control. And I realized that the bulk of my urgency comes from my anxiety. So when Solomon tries to relieve that anxiety by saying it is a bigger problem than you can ever hope to solve, then I have this void of vacuum of urgency that makes me think, man, my faith is a lot smaller than I thought that it was. Like, I've got a lot of work to do. We either accept what Solomon is saying, that these are giant problems, and you're like, they're huge, and you need to accept them and pray about them, and like, you live under the sun, it's not going to be all cotton candy and soap bubbles, you know what I mean? We need to accept that and deal with that with God, and turn to his sovereignty and the fear of God and the discipline of joy. Or what we're going to do is make our world small enough that we can be God in it. And we're going to go crazy and bring everybody around us with us as we try to control that world. This series, I've talked about how it's the wisdom books of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job and then Song of Solomon. The Proverbs is the "you reap what you sow." If you become a better sower, you become a better reaper, you can control. That's that book. Job is like, but sometimes you sow one thing and you reap the exact opposite because everything is completely out of your control, but God is still in control. And Ecclesiastes is the book that's right in the middle and says, but this is life. Life is somewhere in between the two of them. And that's okay because God is in control. And wisdom is accepting that we live in the middle. Wisdom is not learning how to control everything and make it right. Wisdom is accepting that we live in the middle, that there's a time for everything and God controls it, that it doesn't have to rob us of joy, but we can find great joy in the midst of it in faith that God is in control of it. But we have to build this margin of inefficiency in our view of life and not pretend that the toil isn't there. So I'm going to kind of wind down through this with four, like, practices, you know, four things that you do to deal with it. And the first is lament. So I sent, on the weekly, if you're new to the church and you don't get the weekly, that's like our bulletin. It comes out on Fridays. You can go to the website, sign up for it. You should get that. I put a blurb at the beginning of it, and I don't know who reads that. But this one was about, we had the camp out thing. If you went to the camping trip, that was fantastic. We camped out with our elementary kids, and someone came up to me and said, "So you're going to quit, eh?" And I was like, "You read the weekly." And so you can sign up for it and read it yourself. and figure out what that means. But this guy, I heard a podcast, a pastor talking about lament, and I thought, oh, that was really good. I'll find an article. But the article had to do with specifically to pastors, but the lament thing was really good, just about the discipline and the practice of lament and dealing with disappointment. And he brought up this, a third of the Psalms are lament Psalms, and we need it. And then he talked about like a way to work through prayer in a lament format. So did anybody ever learn to pray through the acronym of ACTS? Did anybody else learn that? There's adoration, confession, thanksgiving, and supplication. Just a helpful way to like, okay, when you pray, here's some, just the kind of how you move through prayer. Well, he said there's a way to move through a lament prayer. And so the first one is turn. And so turn to God with whatever it is that you're lamenting. When you realize, man, I'm wound up about whatever this thing is, whether it be societal or personal with God, like, and I'm just keeping it to myself. He said, turn to God with it. And then he said, complain. He said, it's okay to complain with God. And this is the blessing of a third of the Psalms being lament Psalms, is that David was a whiner, you know? And so he would come to God all the time and say, God, what are you doing? And we can do that. And we need to do that. And then he said, ask. And David asked for some very specific things. And so ask for some very specific things of God. And then trust. And a lot of those Psalms, not all of them. Another blessing of those Psalms is that some of them, like, stop at complain. And it's just the end of the Psalm. It's like God knows sometimes it's going to be really bad. And that's okay. But most of them move all the way through. And they end at trust. And they say, and God, I know you are good, and I know I've seen your goodness in the past, and I know I'm going to see your goodness in the future, and so I choose to trust you. And that pastor in Turkey, listen to that podcast, that's what he did. Like, he said, don't let this be about my emotions, let it be about what I'm doing with my will, God, because I am choosing to believe. And there are times when we have to do that. When we don't learn to lament well with God, to turn and complain, and to ask and to trust, then we just bottle it up inside. You know, I don't know if you ever find yourself in like a conversation with somebody in your head that just is on a loop. Like where you're just kind of working out this stuff with somebody, wanting them to say the thing that you want them to say. Okay, maybe it's just me. There's a few therapists in the church that are like, Jeff, we can talk afterwards. It's okay. It just gets toxic when we don't get an outlet. And that's the Lord, and that's why we're a really relational ministry, and groups are a big focus. We want you connected with each other so that it doesn't get toxic. But learn how to lament. Learn how to lament. Work. It's the second one. Work. Again, he says, don't become overly righteous, but he doesn't say, stop trying to become righteous. There's a work to it. Jesus certainly saw all the oppressions on the face of the earth. And didn't say, oh yeah, the poor, well. He said, whatever you've done for the least of these, you've done it for me. And he talks about judgment and says, here's what it's going to be. Did you care for the widow? Did you care for those in prison? Did you care for the poor? Did you care for the naked? Did you clothe the naked? Did you feed the hungry? Like, that's going to be a reflection of your faith. It's not salvific, but it's a reflection of what is salvific. And whatever you've done for the least of those, you've done it for me. Like, he calls us to go and make a difference. He says, go and make disciples of all the nations, baptize in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, teach him to obey everything I commanded you. While he has also said, parable of the sower, I want you to go out and like throw out the seed of the gospel, but know that a quarter of it's going to get eaten up by birds, and a quarter of it's going to get choked out by the thorns, and a quarter of it's going to find shallow soil and just die out, and only a quarter of it is going to find good soil and grow up, and people are going to grow into disciples. So 25% of the time it might work, 75% of the time it's not going to work, but get out there, and you're going to be my witnesses in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria to the ends of the earth. It doesn't mean stop working. Like, work. Do the things. in the Garden of Gethsemane, take this cup from me, but not my will, but yours be done. If anybody understands injustice, it's Jesus. If anybody understands injustice, it's Jesus. But not my will, but yours be done. I was talking to one of my sons a few weeks ago and just experiencing some high school hardship, let's say. And I just said, man, not much will determine the course of someone's life more than how they deal with disappointment, because life is full of it. And resilience is a key, and everybody knows that, you know? And so work. Lament, but work. Hope. I think what this does is channel our hope off of us and onto him. So 2 Corinthians 1, indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death. He, at one point, Paul says, things were so bad, he's writing to this church, says, this has been so bad for us that we despaired of our own lives. And many translate it like we were suicidal. Like we wanted to not have been born. But that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. If we are hoping in us who cannot raise the dead, that's just not smart. He wants us to rely on him who raises the dead. And so all of this that we see under the sun pushes us towards Christ. And it pushes us, like, we live under the sun, and a reality that we live under the sun, and this isn't all there is. So later, well, earlier, in 1 Corinthians 15, he makes this comment, if in Christ we have hope in this life only, we are of all people most to be pitied. And I feel like there's a risk of us doing that as the church today, and it's on me as much as it is on anybody. We just don't talk about heaven that much. And it's because it seems like for a while there was a time that's all they talked about was heaven, and we didn't talk about why it was relevant for earth, but now we just missed the boat. And he says, if it's only about this life, you're just, like, that's pitiful. You're missing it. Like, it's got to point us that we will not always be under the sun, that Jesus is going to come back, that God is going to make things right. There will be resolution. Remember years ago hearing he's like at Yale. He's a Christian guy. He's from the Balkans, like Eastern Europe, and had experienced all sorts of horrible stuff. And he was talking about nonviolence as a means of solving those problems. And he said, if you're in the West and you've lived a pretty comfortable life, it's easy to say, just get over it, nonviolence, just forgive the people. He said, if your land has been invaded and your houses have been burned, and they've stolen all your stuff, and they've raped your sister and killed your mother, don't tell them to get over it and just forgive. Like, it ain't going to be that easy. And you got to understand, like, your privilege. You got to check your privilege in a way, like, of understanding that. He says, you got to, like, what they need is a divine justice, a hope of divine justice. And that is, like, that is a key part of it. God is going to fix that. God is just, and he is going to judge, and that's a good thing. And so our longing for justice, reflected in my kids constantly watching Bones, is totally legitimate. You know, we should long for closure, but our ability to think we are the ones that can deliver it is arrogant and delusional. And then lastly, lament, hope, work, and worship. And so these are his refrains, and I'll be in these the next few weeks. There's nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. You can find joy in the toil. You don't have to pretend it's not there. You don't have to ignore it. He is going to coach us to find joy in the toil. And this I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? And here he really links up with Paul. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. He's the answer to that. So the band can come back up. We have a few more songs. We're going to take communion. Jesus did this with his disciples the night before he went to the cross and said, this is my body that's been broken for you and my blood that's been poured out for you. Do this in remembrance of me, knowing that we're going to need to keep doing this to remember the gospel. And I think it's Like the cross speaks into all of the stuff of Solomon. Jesus understands injustice better than anybody because he was the one that didn't deserve justice, but the one that got everybody's justice. We can think, especially on a personal level, about how we might suffer injustice at the hands of people that are near us or around us or a neighbor or a coworker or a family member. But we're not so quick to think about how they are experiencing injustice from us because we're just as screwed up as they are. Like, we're giving that out just as easy as we're giving it. It's just that we can see a lot more that we take than we can see what we give. And Jesus is the one that takes all that justice for us and gives us the hope. One, that it's all going to be made right. And two, by rising from the dead 3 days later, that God has the power to restore things to the way that they are. So I'm going to ask you to bow your head and close your eyes for just a minute. Like I said, I have no idea what comes to your mind during these sermons. I wish I could control that, but I can't because we live under the sun. I imagine there are some deeply personal things. Deeply personal things that have become toxic inside of you. That you don't even realize that you need to come to the Lord with. That you need to lament, that you need to accept that we live under the sun. That you need to day after day give to Him over and over again. That you need the cross to speak into. My prayer is you can find a bit of healing this morning. We have stations in the back if you'd like someone to pray with. Or if you want to go, and I would encourage you to do this, if there's something God's speaking to you right now, just write it out. Write it out. And like, capture it. And if you have accepted who Christ is and what He's done for you, we invite you to come and take communion and to remember that all of that, all our injustice, all our hope, finds closure at the cross.